Well, hi, everybody. In case you're wondering, I'm not Ravi Zacharias. I have the, you guessed that right. My name is Don Stewart, and it's good to be back and see you folks again. And I have the high and holy privilege of introducing tonight's guest, and it is indeed a privilege. We are indeed blessed to have Dr. Ravi Zacharias here. Just to give you a little bit of a background before we bring him on. He, for 35 years, has spoken all over the world in numerous universities, including Harvard, Princeton, and Oxford. He has twice spoken at the annual prayer breakfast of the United Nations in New York, which marks the beginning of the UN General Assembly each year. Now, a little bit of his history. He was born in India in 1946, and his family immigrated to Canada some 20 years later. When he was pursuing a career in business management, his interest grew, and subsequently he pursued his study in the undergraduate education. He went to one of my favorite schools, Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in Deerfield, Illinois, where, of course, he majored in philosophy, theology, and the such like, religion and cults. Now, he is a very accomplished author. Many of you know, in fact, many of us have read his books and been blessed with them, author of some 20 books. His latest book is from Zondervan, called The End of Reason, A Response to the New Atheists. And he has another one out from Multnomah called New Birth or Rebirth, Jesus Talks to Krishna. Sounds interesting, doesn't it? Jesus Talks to Krishna. Now, he's got a weekly radio program called Let My People Think, and I'm sure it's a fantastic one. It's aired on over 1,700 outlets worldwide, and we're working on trying to get it out here, too. We need this on K-Wave. This would be a wonderful program to have. He's got an everyday weekday program called Just Thinking on almost 400 radio stations, and he's the founder and chairman of RZIM Ministries International. Their headquarters in Atlanta. Now, what they have about 12 itinerant evangelists going around the world, evangelizing, giving the defense of the faith, going in front of political leaders, heads of state, the such like, showing that the Christian faith is reasonable and intelligent, that you don't have to assassinate your brains to be a Christian, but you can be a Christian and think at the same time. And his ministry has been doing that. This is their 25th anniversary of doing it, and it's a fantastic ministry that God has given them. You know, Pastor Brian called me today and asked me if I would introduce Ravi, and I said it would be a privilege. And I started thinking, now, what can I say besides reading, you know, his usual CV about Ravi Zacharias? And there's just one thing that came to mind. As a fellow apologist or defender of the Christian faith, there are people I've looked up to over the years as sort of mentors, and Dr. Ravi Zacharias is. He's got not only the combination of the great mind, but he's got the heart. He reminds me like of the Apostle Paul, the great mind, the great intellect, but the great heart for the ministry. And so it's a rare combination we're going to see tonight, and we indeed are going to get blessed. And I guess the best compliment I can give him as I bring him out tonight is that Ravi Zacharias is to Christian apologists as Chuck Smith is to pastors. In other words, he is up there, he is the best. And so, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, let's give a Calvary Chapel welcome to Dr. Ravi Zacharias.
Hope you feel this happy when it's over as well. It's nice to have a warm welcome and a warm send-off. Somebody said some people bring happiness wherever they go and others bring happiness whenever they go. So I'll be doing both tonight. Thank you very much, Don, for those kind words, and what an honor to be here. I was telling Pastor Chuck that when I'd first moved to the West, it was actually in the mid-60s, but I had moved there. I was only 20 years old then, and my parents had sent my older brother and myself to do some scouting of the land in Canada to see if there was a future for us, which we did. And as I entered into a career in business, the Lord called me into Christian ministry, and I began my undergraduate studies in theology right there in Toronto. It was in the early 70s. That I happened to be in Los Angeles and somebody brought me to Calvary Chapel. We were all meeting in a tent at that time. So that was early 70s. and this is my next visit. So chances are you will not be seeing me here again if it takes that long to come back. But Chuck, I remember hearing you, and those days we both had hair, and it was nice to be here at the meeting at that time. You know, the subject that has been given is a very interesting one, and it runs something like this. Need God, what if I don't? Muhammad Ali was once flying on a plane, and Ali's name is not exactly synonymous with humility. The great, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee, and the greatest, and so on. And they hit some moderate turbulence. When the pilot tells you it's moderate turbulence, it's getting close to the last rites. Mild turbulence you can handle. Moderate turbulence you better be worried about. And so they were all told to fasten their seat belts. Everybody complied except Ali. The flight attendant went over to him and said, "Sir, would you please fasten your seatbelt?" He looked at her and said, "Superman don't need no seatbelt." And she looked at him and said, "And Superman don't need no airplane either." A young corporal once said to Winston Churchill, "I want you to know that I'm a self-made man." And Churchill looked at him and said, "Young man, you have just relieved God of a very solemn responsibility." So when somebody stands up and says, "Do you need God? What if I don't?" The fact of the matter, ladies and gentlemen, is that life is an extremely complex thing. You know, even if you were the sole human being on the planet, and you were to make the comment, "Need God, what if I don't?" you would still at best be only half valid in your reasoning. I don't know if you've heard of this guy who was stranded on an island for many, many years. And they finally found him. And when the rescuers came on there, they saw three huts. And the man said to him, "What are the three huts for?" He said, "Well, the first one is my home. The second one is my church." He said, "What about the third one?" He said, "That's the church I used to go to." Even when you're the sole survivor, you can end up leaving your own church of which you are the lone member. Because there are some things in life which you have to battle out, which is not somebody else's problem. It's your problem. And wherever you go, that problem goes with you. Many years ago, you may remember Garry Kasparov, the famed chess master from Russia. He was going to be challenged by some of the best known makers of computer technology, and they were going to make a computer that would be designed to beat the best of the chess minds. And this computer was beating all of the comers, and Garry Kasparov decided to take it on. And he won. So the best of the IBM minds got together, and they said they were going to design one which Kasparov would never be able to beat. It had studied all of the possible moves he'd made, all of the options that he had, and it took them a long while to put together all of the software needed to take on Garry Kasparov. Kasparov got rather terrified at the prospect of being beaten. He went into hiding for several weeks to concentrate and prepare, and he said he was terrified because he did not want to lose to a computer and thereby lose human dignity. And I read that, I thought, what? He's afraid that because a computer beats him at chess, he's lost human dignity? I lost mine after the calculators came out, and he's worried about losing to a computer. David Gelertner, who was professor of computer science at Yale at that time, in Time magazine, responded to this challenge and the fear of Garry Kasparov. Let me read for you a couple of the paragraphs from David Gelertner's article. The name of the computer was Deep Blue. He says, "The idea that Deep Blue has a mind is absurd. How can an object that wants nothing, fears nothing, enjoys nothing, needs nothing, and cares about nothing have a mind? It can win at chess, but not because it wants to. It isn't happy when it wins or sad when it loses. What are Deep Blue's after-the-match plans? If it happens to beat Kasparov, Is it hoping to take Deep Pink out for a night? No, it doesn't care about chess or anything else. It plays the game for the same reason a calculator adds or a toaster toasts, because it is a machine designed for that purpose. No matter what feats they perform, inside there will always be a big fat zero. No computer can achieve artificial thought without achieving artificial emotion too. Having said that, he says, in the long run, I doubt if there is any kind of human behavior computers cannot fake, any kind of performance they cannot put on. It is also conceivable that one day computers will be better than humans at nearly everything. I can imagine that a person might someday have a computer for a best friend. Oh, but that would be sad. Like having a dog for your best friend, only sadder. But the gap between the human and the surrogate is permanent and will never be closed. Machines will continue to make life easier, healthier, richer, and more puzzling. And human beings will continue to care ultimately about the same things they always have about one another, and many of them about God. Isn't it fascinating that on an article about chess, with the grandmaster pitted against a computer designed by man, that a professor of computer science ultimately has to come out with a bottom line, that the distinction is ultimately we care, and we care about God. I don't know how many of you have read the Canadian writer's book, Douglas Copeland. It's a brilliant book, written sort of as a rebel from the 60s and 70s, and he tracks the lives of four or five of his buddies, all of whom went different ways, and his book is called Life After God. He got into the drug scene and this and that, and talked about finding release and relief from the notion of the transcendent, that life was now all about merrymaking and doing your own thing, total, undiluted autonomy. You do not expect what he is going to say in the closing paragraph, and here's what he says, and I quote, "Now here is my secret. I want to tell this to you with an openness of heart. I doubt that I shall ever achieve this openness again. So I pray you're in a quiet room as you hear these words of mine. My secret is this, that I need God, that I am sick and I can no longer make it alone. I need God to help me give because I no longer seem to be capable of giving. I need God to help me to be kind, as I no longer seem capable of kindness on my own. I need God to help me love, as I seem being beyond able to even love." Incredible conclusion from a man who's writing, and the book is totally an expedition into a secularized consciousness, living in this nimbus of a world without God. Total, as I said, unmitigated autonomy. And he ends with this secret, and he says this caveat, "I may never reach such candor again, so I hope you're alone when you listen to me. I need God, because I don't even want to give without him. I cannot be kind without him. I cannot even love without him." Here's the point he's really making. There are points of reference in your life. The descriptions of those points are totally devoid of any meaning because they have no ontic or outside point of reference to define those terms. You simply cannot talk about love without a point of reference for love and some common ground of understanding on it. He says you can't even talk of being kind. So you see, even when you're all alone, stranded on an island, you end up building two buildings because you get fed up of yourself. And then when you bring in the human component of all the other entities that are in this world, for any person to say, "Need God, what if I don't?" you're actually denying the very values which are indispensable to human dignity and human transactions. Wasn't it G.K. Chesterton who said, "The tragedy of disbelieving in God is not that a person ends up believing in nothing. Alas, it is much worse. A person may end up believing in anything." And when the tendency comes to turn away from God, the biggest question is, to what? You would think by the person who says, I don't need God, there's just some kind of monolithic option you have out there that everybody will converge into the same line of thinking. It is simply not true. And that's what the new atheists are having a problem with. They seem much better at smelling rotten eggs than laying good ones. All the castigation that is involved in debunking this and debunking that, like Bart Ehrsman now writing about God's problem, the problem of evil, 25 pages dedicated to the Holocaust, as if we didn't know what happened in the Holocaust, giving God the kind of the footnote that God has to explain all this. Where does he get his notion of the absolute from? How does he arrive at the idea that evolutionary ethics leads us to human dignity? The fact of the matter is, evolutionary ethics is ultimately reductionistic. Charles Darwin himself said, if the philosophical extensions are made from my naturalistic assumptions, he said the possibility of the future is nothing short of unbridled violence. Nature red in tooth and claw. That's what it is. What I want to do, ladies and gentlemen, is take for you a world without God and show you what it means. And I'm going to punctuate it with the alternatives that God has given to us, especially the God of the Old and the New Testaments through the person of Jesus Christ, and show you the paradigmatic distinctions. What is it that the worldview of the non-theist or the atheist or the total secularist presents vis-a-vis the worldview of God, and you tell me which squares more with reality and with the idealisms which we ought to pursue as human beings. Here it is. The man lived between 1844 and 1899, or 1844 and 1900, I guess, to be precise. He died at the age of 56. He was a German philosopher, Nietzsche. His father was a pastor. Both of his grandfathers were in the ministry. But Nietzsche, this brilliant young man, decided he was going to clench his fist against God and turn his back upon God. Here's what he said in one of his parables called The Madman. Have you not heard of that madman who lit a lantern in the bright morning hours, ran to the marketplace and cried incessantly, I'm looking for God, I'm looking for God. As many of those who did not believe in God were standing together there, he excited considerable laughter. Have you lost him then, said one. Did God lose his way like a child, said another. Maybe he's hiding. Is he afraid of us? Has he gone on a voyage or emigrated? Thus they shouted and laughed him to scorn. But the madman sprang into their midst and pierced them with his glances. Where is God? He cried. I'll tell you, we have killed him, you and I. Now what he means by that metaphor is that philosophically we've done away with him. We no longer need him. He was some kind of a vestige of an antiquated worldview. We've come of age. We have killed him, you and I. He's the one who popularized the phrase, God is dead. But the madman sprang into the midst and pierced him with his glances. Where is God? He cried, I'll tell you, we have killed him, you and I. We are all his murderers. But how did we do this? How were we able to drink up the sea? Who gave us such a large sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? What did we do when we unchained this earth from its sun? Whither is it moving now? Whither are we moving now? Away from all suns, maybe? Are we not perpetually falling backwards, forwards, sidewards in all directions? Is there any up or down left? Are we not straying through an infinite nothing? Do we not feel the breath of empty space? Has it not suddenly become colder? Is not more and more night coming on us all the time? Must not lanterns have to be lit now in the morning hours? Do we not hear anything yet of the noise of the grave diggers who are burying God? Do we not smell anything yet of God's decomposition? God's decomposed too, you know, and he is dead. He remains dead, and you and I have killed him. Now, how will we, the murderer of all murderers, compose ourselves? Because that which was the holiest and mightiest of all that the world has possessed has bled to death under our knives. Who will wipe this blood from us? With what water can we purify ourselves? What festivals of atonement? What sacred games will we need to invent? Is not this the greatest of deeds too great for us to handle? Must not now we ourselves have to become God simply to seem worthy of what we have done. There's never been a greater deed than this, you know. And whoever is born after us for the sake of this deed shall be part of a higher history than all history hitherto. Here the madman fell silent and again regarded his listeners. They too were silent and they stared at him in astonishment. At last he threw his lantern to the ground and it broke and went out. I come too early, maybe. My time has not yet come. It has been related further that on the same day the madman entered many churches and there sang a requiem, Aeternum Deo. Let out and quieted, he said to have retorted each time, what are these churches now if they are not the tombs and sepulchres of God? He is dead. We have killed him. You know what is ironic about this? The parable is on a man called the madman. You know how Nietzsche spent the last 13 years of his own life? Insane. And there his mother would sit by his bedside, as sometimes for 4 or 5 weeks he would be in absolute silence, and suddenly, as of a volcano under eruption, he would blurt out again. And you know what he would blurt out? Verses of scripture he'd learned as a younger man. The irony of this. Who has killed him? We have killed him. Do you know what he said? Are we moving away from the sun? S-U-N. You know what G.K. Chesterton said? God is like the sun. We cannot look at it, but without it, we cannot look at anything else. That's the point. God casts that light upon values and issues that are absolutely vacuous, if not totally irrational, outside of a transcendent point of meaning. That's what makes God inescapable in every generation. He may have been talking about empty churches. This is hardly an empty church. I believe it is critical, ladies and gentlemen, that we try to understand what is happening in America today especially, and in the Western world in extension, and what we are doing to ourselves by attempting to re-kill the God that they tried to kill in the previous century. And so the big boys, Hitchens and Dawkins and Dennett and Harris, are at it, making all of their money on God whom they don't believe in. I remember when I was doing my graduate school, I had a classmate who was an atheist. And one day when he told me that, I said, what on earth are you in a seminary studying theology as an atheist? He looked at me and he said, because there's big bucks in the God racket. Seems to be some pretty big bucks in the atheistic racket as well right now. And the knowledge of the holy is diminishing. And we are moving into that sense of straying into an infinite nothing, where we do not understand at this stage in America's history and in the Western civilization's so-called progress, we do not understand the most fundamental questions of life. What does it mean to be a human being? What does it mean to be a viable entity in your mother's womb? What does human sexuality mean? What does the home mean? We don't have definitions for the most fundamental issues of life. We are straying through an infinite nothing, and lanterns are having to be lit in the morning hours because it has suddenly become so dark. And that's what happens when you say, what if I don't need God? Let me take you through 4 issues that you will then not be able to deal with existentially, at least existentially, and even logically. Ultimately, you will lack coherence in life itself. These 4 issues are necessary in your thinking and begging for definition all the time. And outside of God, there is no way to come to terms with what I'm talking about now. The first one is this. If you say you don't need God, you may as well say, laws? What if I don't need them? Scientific laws? What if I don't believe them? Get onto the Eiffel Tower and jump and you'll find out You've not broken the law, you've broken yourself because you didn't believe the law. And the fact of the matter is that the ultimate search in the human heart is the search for a moral point of reference, how you arrive at right and wrong, how you arrive at good and bad, how you arrive at what is morally good and what is morally evil. Isn't it interesting? In humanistic terms and in naturalistic terms, we tell everybody it's time plus matter plus chance. We happen to be here. But at the same time, we raise the problem of evil. What does evil really mean in a mechanistic universe? How does one define what is evil unless you first assume what is purpose? Every definition of evil is based on an assumption of purpose. That life has essential worth, life has essential destiny, life has an essential direction. And so when you start talking about the Holocaust and saying this ought not to have been done, the ought not implies an ought which assumes there is a purpose and a direction for that individual life. Now, I'm always fascinated by the questions that were asked of Jesus. You know, people like to ask questions sometimes because they want to be a nuisance. And so this boy comes up to Jesus and says to him, is it all right to pay taxes to Caesar? It's one question I wish Jesus had answered differently. I would love for him to have said no. And then come every April 15th, imagine giving transcendent leverage to rebellion and say no, not on your life. Jesus looks at him and says, have you got a coin? He says, yeah, can you give me that coin? And he looks at him and says, what do you see on this coin? He says, Caesar. Whose image is on this coin? He says, Caesar. He says, give to Caesar that which is Caesar's and give to God that which is God's. Now, here's the point. The questioner was a disingenuous questioner. You know why? He should have had a follow-up question. He should have said, what belongs to God? You know what Jesus would have said? Whose image is on you? Whose image is on you? Do you know God pays you the greatest compliment of giving you intrinsic worth by telling you He's made you in His own image, the Imago Dei? What do you think the Ten Commandments are all about? They can be reduced in one word, to one word, sacred. Life is sacred. Time is sacred. Your worship is sacred. Your property is sacred. Your marriage is sacred. And you desacralize life, there go all of the commandments and all of the laws which actually make life ultimately unlivable. And you know, they were given one commandment at creation, not to eat of the knowledge of the tree of good and evil. What that really meant is, you have no right to be redefining good and evil. And as soon as that one law was broken, Moses had to come up with 613. Have you ever been on a plane where they tell you the restroom is, the washroom is equipped with smoke detectors? Do not tamper, break, destroy, or disengage. They've got about 10 lines out there. Why don't you just say, don't mess with it? You know why? Because there's always somebody who'll find a different definition of mess. And so you don't tamper, don't destroy, don't disengage, don't touch, don't do this, don't do all of that. You know? That's what happens when you violate the sacred. You end up dying the death of 1,000 qualifications in the process. Now let me tell you this, you can try as hard as you can as an atheist to define moral reasoning, you cannot. Here is one of the most vociferous atheists of our time, Kai Nielsen. Here's what he says, he's a Canadian philosopher. We have not been able to show that pure reason requires the moral point of view, or that really rational persons unhoodwinked by myth or ideology, need not be individual egoists or classical amoralists. Reason doesn't decide here. The picture I have just painted for you is not a pleasant one, and reflection on this actually depresses me. Pure practical reason, even with a good knowledge of the facts, will not take you to morality. Why does he say that? Because all you need to do is say, morality, what if I don't need it? The moral absolutes that God gives to us are absolutes that are built into the purpose of human life, not to destroy the imago Dei, not to destroy the image of God of your neighbor. You know, Joseph Stalin was a young seminary student preparing to go into ministry. It's an incredible twist and irony in history. He was a seminarian studying theology, going to go into ministry, and he came to the conclusion that he didn't need God. When he became the head man of that Soviet Empire, even Lenin said he was fearful of what this man would ultimately do. Do you know what he did? He killed 15 million of his own people. Think about that. He was torturing them. He was dehumanizing them. And as Ofov often told the story of a Western diplomat who'd gone to see him and said, Mr. Stalin, how much longer are you going to keep torturing your own people and expecting them to follow you? And he sat at the table and asked for a live chicken to be brought to him. The chicken was brought and he clutched the chicken and defeathered that bird systematically till the whole body was denuded. And he put that live chicken down on the floor, picked up a piece of bread, walked away for a few paces, and the chicken hobbled over towards him, nestled between his trouser legs for warmth. And Stalin bent down with a piece of bread in his hand, and the chicken started pecking away at it. He said, Madam, did you get your answer? I tortured that chicken. It'll follow me for food the rest of its life. People are like that chicken. You torture them, and they will follow you for food the rest of their lives. You know, my wife is here tonight, and I'd been invited to lecture some years ago at the Lenin Military Academy in Moscow and to engage the faculty in a discussion at the Center for Geopolitical Strategy in Moscow as well, where all of their heads of state have graduated in the last two or three generations and more. And I remember at the end of that, one of my discussions there, which lasted 3 hours with the faculty, all of whom were atheists. And the head of the department, the head of the institution was shaking hands with us, and they were lined up to bid us goodbye. And he shook my hands and he says, Mr. Zacharias, I want to thank you for coming here. I believe the answers you've given to us today are true, but it's very difficult to change after 70 years of believing a lie. My wife and I were taken out for lunch by the general, and I told him the story about Stalin. He was sitting across the table as we were eating this very modest lunch, and his lips started to quiver and his eyes became moist. He didn't know how to even respond to it. God gave me the great privilege of seeing General Kershon come to Christ and give his life over to Christ, because the man who had made himself God over his own people. Found out there's no way when man becomes God that you don't end up actually dehumanizing the rest of us in the process. For humanity, all of us have that corruption of heart where it is not just power that corrupts, it's an intoxication with our egos and ourselves that ultimately breaks us up from the inside. Morality, who needs it? God, who needs it? Do you know, we are struggling to answer these questions now. And listen to the poet and listen to the philosopher who deals with this issue of moral absolutes. Both are very sarcastic. Both of them Englishmen. Steve Turner, who says this: we believe today in Marx, Freud, and Darwin. We believe everything is okay, as long as you don't hurt anyone to the best of your definition of hurt and to the best of your definition of knowledge. We believe in sex before, during, and after marriage. We believe in the therapy of sin. We believe that adultery is fun. We believe that taboos are taboo. We believe that everything's getting better despite evidence to the contrary. The evidence must be investigated, and you can prove anything with evidence. We believe there's something in horoscopes, UFOs, and bent spoons. Jesus was a good man, just like Buddha, Muhammad, and ourselves. He was a good moral teacher, although we think some of his good morals were really bad. We believe that all religions are basically the same. At least the ones that we read were. They all believe in love and goodness. They only differ on matters of creation, sin, heaven, hell, God, and salvation. We believe that after death comes the nothing, because when you ask the dead what happens, they say nothing. If death is not the end and if the dead have lied, then it's compulsory heaven for all, excepting perhaps Hitler, Stalin, and Genghis Khan. We believe in Masters and Johnson. What's selected is average, what's average is normal, and what's normal is good. We believe in total disarmament. We believe there are direct links between warfare and bloodshed. Americans should beat their guns into tractors and the Russians would be sure to follow. We believe that man is essentially good. It's only his behavior that lets him down. This is the fault of society. Society is the fault of conditions, and conditions are the fault of society. We believe that each man must find the truth that is right for him, and reality will adapt accordingly. The universe will readjust, history will alter. We believe that there is no absolute truth, except for the truth that there is no absolute truth. We believe in the rejection of creeds and the flowering of individual thought. And then he puts this postscript. If chance be the father of all flesh, disaster is his rainbow in the sky. And when you hear state of emergency, sniper kills 10, youths go looting, bomb blast school, it's but the sound of man worshipping his maker. If chance is the father of all flesh, disaster is his rainbow in the sky. And when you hear state of emergency, sniper kills 10, troops on rampage, youths go looting, and bomb blast school, it is but the sound of man worshipping his maker. Listen to the words of G.K. Chesterton. The new rebel who's rebelling against all authority is a skeptic and will not entirely trust anything. He has no loyalty, therefore he can never be a true revolutionist. And the fact that he doubts everything gets in his way when he wants to denounce anything. For all denunciation implies a moral doctrine of some kind. And the modern revolutionist doubts not only the institution he denounces, but the doctrine by which he denounces it. So he writes one book complaining that imperial oppression insults the purity of women, and then writes another book, a novel, in which he insults it himself. He curses the Sultan because Christian girls lose their virginity, then curses Mrs. Grundy because they keep it. As a politician, he cries out that war is a waste of life, then as a philosopher, that life itself is a waste of time. A Russian pessimist will denounce a policeman for killing a peasant, then prove by the highest philosophical principles that the peasant ought to have killed himself. A man denounces marriage as a lie, then denounces aristocratic profligates for treating it as a lie. He calls the flag a bubble, then blames the oppressors of Poland or Ireland because they take away that bubble. The man of the school goes first to a political meeting where he complains that savages are treated as if they were beasts. Then he takes his hat and umbrella and goes on to a scientific meeting where he proves that they practically are beasts. In short, the modern revolutionist, being an infinite skeptic, is always engaged in undermining his own minds. In his book on politics, he attacks men for trampling on morality. In his book on ethics, he attacks morality for trampling on men. Therefore, the modern man in revolt has become practically useless for all purposes of revolt. By rebelling against everything, he has lost his right to rebel against anything. A New York Times journalist phoned about 4 weeks ago and he asked me what I thought of this economic crisis. I said, I'd like it if you'd answer a question for me. I said, at all of our Ivy League schools for the last 2 decades, we've been teaching all of our young business scholars that ethics are all relative, that there are no absolutes. Now when they go and live relativistic lifestyles, we want to put them behind bars. I said, the very ethic we taught them, they're living out. Now we wonder what's gone wrong. Silence. Yes, that's true, isn't it? I said, yes, it's true. I said, when Enron messes up with the lives of so many people at the helm, we're being relativists. There were no absolutes. I was showing an audience yesterday what I have in my pocket is a $100 million bill. Gives me a wonderful sense of security. This is an authentic $100 million bill. Don't laugh at it. There's only one problem. It's from Zimbabwe. where the inflation rate is 500 quintillion percent per year, and prices are doubling every 31 hours, and the people there are not laughing. You know what it says underneath $100 million? On or before 31st December 2008. I got this in October, 2 months before it expired. Wouldn't have bought me a loaf of bread then, buys nothing now. Do you know why? There is no point of reference of actual value for this dollar bill. You want to talk about morality without a point of reference? The same thing will happen as what's happened economically today, where there have been no morals behind the scenes, and it's payday someday. There is no moral law. There is no absolute. One philosopher of science says, ours is an age where ethics has become obsolete. It is superseded by science, deleted by psychology, dismissed as emotive by philosophy. It is drowned in compassion, evaporates into aesthetics, and retreats before relativism. And the usual moral distinctions between good and bad are simply drowned in a maudlin emotion in which we feel more sympathy for the murderer than for the murdered, for the adulterer than for the betrayed, and in which we have actually begun to believe that the real guilty party, the one who somehow caused it all, is the victim and not the perpetrator of the crime. Without God, there's no moral law. Without God, there is no meaning. You block God out. Where are you going to find your meaning? What does life ultimately really mean? You turn to the scientist to give you meaning. You turn to the skeptic to give you meaning. And you go through life beginning to find out that life has sort of become a kind of a circular thing where you run on, it's a treadmill, you're going round and round and round, or else like the myth of Sisyphus, you roll the stone up only to watch that stone rolling down again, and life becomes this purposeless, nihilistic, desperate, repetitive action where it has no ultimate destiny, no ultimate point, no ultimate essential value. Can you really talk of values and talk about purpose apart from God? Life becomes so despairing in that. You contrast the world of naturalism and secularism. You contrast that world which offers no meaning. No meaning. Oh yes, they've tried. It is nothing more than a game with words. The emperor has no clothes. Lee Iacocca said it this, in these twilight years of his life, he's asked himself this question, what has it all really come down to for me? And I quote him, he said, fame and fortune is for the birds. So what has it come down to? Fame and fortune is for the birds. And then he ends by saying, if you haven't loved your very family in the process, what has it really mattered at the end of the day? Jack Higgins, the famous novelist, the best-known novel, The Eagle Has Landed, somebody interviewing him asked him what his thoughts were on life and what he now knew that he'd wished he'd known as a younger man. And he said, I wished I'd known then what I know now, that when you get to the top, there's nothing there. There's nothing there. Ted Turner said the same thing. He put it differently. He said, you arrive at the top and you're greeted by a bag full of holes. Think about it. What is your life meaning right now? What do your actions mean? Why do you go to the places you go to? Why do you keep the vows that you keep? What does all this actually mean? You know, can I just take a few moments and summarize for you what it is that Christ actually offers you in meaning? It's a whole new paradigm. Do you know what he offers you? He offers you one of the most daunting realities to begin with. He enables you to see your own heart as God sees it. It's a glorious day when you can look inward and identify who the real you is. He took the children of Israel wandering for 40 years when he could have taken them in that journey in 6 weeks. And he said, I did this so that you would see what was in your own heart. Evil, adulteries, envy, strife, murder, jealousies, all this that rages within every human heart. I was telling an audience some time ago, and you forgive me for the bluntness of this. I was flying out of a country I shall leave unnamed. It was taking one stop and then on its way to Hanoi. It's a few years ago. And there was a Dutch woman sitting next to me, and we got into a conversation. She was very guarded in disclosing who she was. I was guarded in disclosing who I was, because if you tell anybody, you know, you're a preacher or you talk about spiritual things, it ends the conversation right there, or you're being psychoanalyzed for the rest of the journey. So I generally tell them I try to solve people's problems. And that opens up a whole conversation. She said to me, I have a work that takes care of children. I kept probing and probing. And when she found out what I did and what my life was, she said, I can tell you what I do. She said, I was in this country because I'm rescuing children from being sexually abused. I said, were you successful here? She says, you know, there's a part of town in this country where we just took off from. It's called Snake Alley. She said, men come at the end of each day from their work, and they are given a concoction of snake's blood and hard liquor. And then they are given whatever they want to satisfy themselves. She said, I walked through that street every night, and last night I rescued an 18-month-old baby girl who was being sexually molested by this man who'd come back from work to do what he wanted to do. And I still remember when I first heard that, I thought, you know, I'm going to be sick to my stomach. I don't even want to think or put in my mind the image of what has just been portrayed. What has happened to the mind of a man who wants to do that? What is the matter with the minds of human beings who offer that to the man who wants this? What happens to a government that turns a blind eye to this sort of a thing and allows this to exist? You know, before we stand back and think that evil is out there, Jesus very quickly corrects all of that and says, evil is in your heart and in my heart. We are all as badly off. But then what he offers as a rescue for this is not an education. It's not a higher degree. D.L. Moody used to say that if a man is stealing nuts and bolts from a railway track and you want to change him, you send him to college, at the end of his education, he will steal the whole railway track. Do we need any proof of that now? You know, we used to say you can take that to the bank. Or we'd say better insure that. You better be careful which bank you take it to and which insurance company you insure it with. We've lost all of this in the process. And all I'm saying to you is what Jesus said is when you look at your own heart, there is nothing you can do in all of your volitional power to change the inclinations of your heart. It's always evil. It is that interjection of divine transformation and grace that changes your hungers and changes your wants. It takes away the passion for the here and the now and the this. The transcending reality of what is spiritual and what is eternal and what is ultimately true and noble and good. And not only does he disclose that and offer that, one of the best things he offers for you and for me is forgiveness. I want you to listen to me carefully. Have you ever thought of the logic of unforgiveness? Have you ever looked at this world and seen the logic of unforgiveness? If you go to Gaza today, you will see an unforgiveness that has lasted 5,000 years. In Albania, they have a law. It's called the Law of Kanun. The law basically says if anybody has wronged you or your family, it is up to you to avenge it or pass that on to the next generation so the next generation can avenge it. And this law of unforgiveness goes on and on and on. If you have anybody in your heart today you have not forgiven, that person right now controls you more than anybody else. And I stand before you tonight to say that Christ discloses your heart. He transforms your heart, offers you the forgiveness that only God in His grace can offer. Like the person, the elementary school teacher who wrote, he came to my desk with a quivering lip, the lesson was done. Have you a new sheet for me, dear teacher? I've spoiled this one. I took his sheet all soiled and blotted and gave him a new one all unspotted, and into his tired heart I cried, do better now, my child. I went to the throne with a trembling heart. The day was done. Have you a new day for me, dear master? I've spoiled this one. He took my day all soiled and blotted and gave me a new one all unspotted, and into my tired heart he cried, do better now, my child. God's forgiveness of your heart and cleansing. Those are just three aspects which the world cannot completely understand. Bernard Shaw described forgiveness as a beggar's refuge. He's right. You are a beggar, and I'm a beggar, but it is not a refuge. It's the grace of God that's willing to pronounce you and me clean and give us that new start in life. How do you find meaning? Ultimately, the hunger for meaning is found in one thing and one thing alone. It's in a right relationship with God, who discloses to you the blueprint of your existence and the purpose for which He's made you. And then your eyes see your fellow human beings in the same way that God sees them, like Jacob and Esau, who had quarreled with each other and were trying to do away with each other, and the grace of God met both of them, and one says to the other, I now see in your face the face of God. Jean-Paul Sartre, the French existentialist, described hell as other people. He said, I'm fine until you come into my life. God says no. He wants that relationship with you and makes you then one of His children to show what relationships are all about. God Himself is a being in relationship in the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, where love and communion and community abide. As I move on, I say to you that outside of God, there is no moral law. Outside of God, there is no meaning. And I turn to this, outside of God there is no hope. There is no hope. You see, Christ not only went to the cross to offer you and me forgiveness, Christ rose again from the dead to offer you and me eternal hope. I want to tell you a little story I was telling some friends last night, and I'll bring this to a close so that we have enough time to answer your questions at the end. But I remember some time ago, a few years ago, I'd been invited by the former Archbishop of Canterbury to bring along four or five, I was one of them actually asked by somebody else whom the Archbishop had invited, and he asked me to join them. And to take along four or five ministers to go to Israel, and we were going to meet with the Israeli political leadership and the Palestinian political leadership, all of the factions of the groups there, to try and bring some semblance of order to a peace table and talk about the stopping of the killing in all of this. We had no political agenda, just a spiritual charge to talk to the people. And so we were meeting with many of them. And on the last day, we met with one of the founders of Hamas. He's quite renowned and quite well known. His name is Sheikh Talal. And Sheikh Talal hosted us in his home in Ramallah for lunch that afternoon. And it was quite an eerie conversation. He'd been in prison for 18 years and had been released. His son, a powerfully built young man, had served a prison sentence. Two or three of his children had died, I think, in suicide bombings or something like that. And so this tough, rough guy is talking to us very animatedly about his passion to get things right here and on and on. And as the hours went by and we were to get back to our hotel and then leave early the next morning, The Archbishop, as in each occasion, gave each one of us to ask one question. So I looked at Sheikh Talal and asked him the question that I wanted to ask him, what he thought of suicide bombing. And I guessed I'd asked the wrong question. I was not very happy with his answer. The room was just filled with smoke. And I looked at him and I said, Sheikh Talal, I'm not really comfortable nor am I happy with your answer, but that's your answer. I said, you and I may never meet again. But what I want to tell you is this. And I'd never thought of this before. Never thought of it. It just came out of the blue. I said, not far from where you and I are sitting, I said, 5,000 years ago, a man by the name of Abraham, whom you revere and I respect, took his son up a mountain. Do you remember that story? And he nodded. I said, you believe it was Ishmael. We as Christians believe it was Isaac. I said, let's not argue about that now. Can we agree he took his son up to the mountain to offer a sacrifice as a description of his faith that God would be sovereign over his life? And as the axe is about to come down, Sheikh, I said, that God stopped his arm. You remember that? He said, yes. I said, you know what God said? He shook his head. I said, God said, I myself will provide. He nodded. I said, Sheikh, very close to where you and I are sitting is another hill. 2,000 years ago, God kept that promise and took his own son up that hill. And this time, as the axe came down, it didn't stop. He just looked at me. I said, Sheikh Talal, until you and I receive the son that God has offered for our human predicament, we will be offering our own sons and daughters on the battlefields of this land to own and to have power and to have dominion over others. Until we receive his son, we'll be sacrificing our own sons. There was pin drop silence. Nobody said anything after that. And I said, boy, I've really done it now. We picked up all our belongings and we walked down the stairs where these well-guarded SUVs were waiting. We were all getting in, and as I was about to get into my door, Sheikh Talal came over to me. He's a big guy, a solid guy. I have two metal rods in my back from surgery and have to be very careful with how tough the person is who hugs me. He grabbed me by the shoulders like this, patted me on both sides of the face, kissed me on both sides of the face, and he says, you're a good man. I hope I see you again someday. And that was it. I hope I see you again someday. You know, when Christ offers himself to you and to me, it is not only in the cross that he deals with the predicament. The marvelous thing is that he talked about going to the grave and talked about triumphing over the grave and gives us the hope that reflects the values of the eternal and the ultimate sense of us being in communion with God and with one another, for those of us who have followed him and gone the path that the way he has called us to, in choosing him to be the way, the truth, and the life, which is what God has given to us in him. In the early 70s, I remember preaching in Vietnam. I was a theology student going to minister to the American troops and to the prisoners of war and to the Vietnamese. And one American soldier wrote this poem. I have never lost it. I have kept it in my possession. Lord God, I have never spoken to you, but now I want to say, how do you do? You see, God, they told me you didn't exist. And like a fool, I believed all this. Last night from a shell hole, I saw your sky. I figured right then they had told me a lie. Had I taken time to see the things you made, I'd have known they weren't calling a spade a spade. I wonder, God, if you'll take my hand. Somehow I feel that you'll understand. Funny I had to come to this hellish place before I had time to see your face. I guess there really isn't much more to say, but I'm sure glad, God, that I've met you today. I guess 0 hour will soon be here, but I'm not afraid since I know you're near. the signal. Well, God, I'll have to go. I like you lots. I want you to know. Look now, this will be a horrible fight. Who knows, I may come to your house tonight, though I wasn't friendly to you before. I wonder, God, if you'd wait at your door. Look, I'm crying. I'm shedding tears. I'll have to go now. God, goodbye. Strange now since I met you. I'm not afraid to die. Hope. Not only for the here, but for the eternal. Times may seem hopeless. Life at times may seem like it's so dark that there's no light at the end of the tunnel. Christ says to you and me, in him is our hope, because he is the one who conquered the grave. And the Bible tells us, eye has not seen, ear has not heard, neither has entered into the heart of man the things which God has prepared to them that love him, for them that love him. You know, in this audience tonight, I have two of my daughters, I have my wife, I have some of my colleagues who are here for another meeting tomorrow. And I also have the man in the audience. I probably won't even get a chance to say hello to him afterwards, but through whom I first heard the gospel when I was a teenager in Delhi. And it began my journey, which ultimately took me to a hospital room and a bed of suicide. No hope. No hope. I couldn't have given you one drop of paint if you were to paint a canvas of my life that offered me hope. I knew who I was on the inside. All my buddies were passing. I was failing. I knew I didn't have what my father wanted me to have. I knew I wasn't going to make it. And when this is put into your hands, and one little verse stands out, and you're on a bed of suicide, and you read the lines that you can't even read, they're being read to you because your eyes are blurred from trying to get the poison out of your system. And you hear the words, because I live, you also shall live. When I buried my mother, when she died at the age of 57, I asked my dad if we could put those words onto her gravestone, because she was by my side when these words were read to me. And today on her grave in Toronto are the words with her name and date of birth and death. Because I live, you shall live also. A few years ago, my wife and I were in Delhi. And I said, can we go and find my grandmother's grave? I was only 8 or 9, I said, when she died. I don't remember a thing except a hymn was sung at her funeral. Abide with me, fast falls the eventide. The darkness deepens, Lord, with me abide. Remember that so clearly. We went there, we couldn't find her grave because it was sunk under sand, under all the wet mud out there. But we found the location and I got a gardener to come and clear the dirt. And he's using the shovel and the spade and a hose to wash it off. And gradually her name emerges. Date of birth and death. Below that, Jesus said, because I live, you shall live also. My wife grabbed my arm and said, can you believe what we are seeing right now? You know, I've written a book called The Grand Weaver. He'll pull the threads together in your life. And when you stand before him someday, every thread will make sense. And you will find the hope that needeth not be ashamed. Because you're covered by the grace of one who walked to Calvary for you and rose again from the dead for you to offer you hope and eternal life. Tell me what atheism has to offer as hope. It's in you. And if you look inside, that's pretty meager. No law, no hope, no meaning. And ultimately, you deny God. And if you find out that he actually exists, there is no recovery at that point. You know, Pascal said this, and I'll close with this. Should a man be in error in supposing the Christian religion to be true. He could not be a loser by mistake. But how irreparable is his loss, and how inexpressible his danger, who should err in supposing it to be false. Should a man be in error in supposing the Christian religion to be true, he could not be a loser by mistake, but how irreparable is his loss, and how inexpressible his danger, who should err in supposing it to be false. This wager of Pascal has been the most misunderstood thing that I have ever heard interpreted. Pascal is not here betting and thinking he's got the better bet. Pascal is saying this: if all you have to offer in life outside of God is some kind of fulfillment and personal existential satisfaction, I get that in God. But what I get in God is more than that. So if your test is some kind of a temporary fulfillment of your 70 years, I have found it in my spiritual belief. But I have found more than that. I found the truth, and I found an eternal destiny. So your test I have already met. My test you have not met. That's what he's saying. You know, I've written a series of books called The Great Conversations, Imaginary Conversations between Jesus and somebody. The first one was The Lotus and the Cross, Jesus talks to Buddha. Second one was Sense and Sensuality, Jesus talks to Oscar Wilde. The third one was The Lamb and the Fuhrer, Jesus talks to Hitler. Fourth is New Birth or Rebirth, Jesus talks to Krishna. Now, what I do is take the words of these people in their settings and what they said on certain issues and what Jesus said in response in very similar situations, bring in two or three other foil personalities and imagine a conversation there of what would go on. The one that I did on Oscar Wilde, Sense and Sensuality, the third personage talking there is Pascal. The reason I picked Pascal is because both Pascal and Oscar Wilde had their funeral services in the same church in Paris. Pascal's coat still hangs there, and in his coat is sewn in his testimony, which he never wanted to lose. Oscar Wilde, at his funeral, didn't have one bar of music played. This was the hedonist. Not far from that church, he lay dying in his 40s after having lived a totally sensuous life, something like Michel Foucault of recent vintage, that there were no absolutes but your own absolutes. There was no boundary in life and joy at all. When Oscar Wilde was dying, he looked at his friend Robbie Ross and he said to him, "Get me a priest." Robbie Ross was stunned. And Wilde, in his poem, The Ballad of Reading Jail, said, "Because there's only one big enough now to forgive this heart of mine, and that is the Christ of Calvary." Jean-Paul Sartre lived as an atheist. On his deathbed, he said to his mistress, "It is unlivable." Anthony Flew, when I was in my graduate school days, the biggest known atheist of that time, I had to read everything Flew had written here. It saved me an awful lot of time if he told me what he was going to say in years to come. Now he says he no longer can sustain his atheism logically. Ladies and gentlemen, like Douglas Copeland, you better admit the secret. You need God. You need God. You cannot love without Him. You cannot even be kind or understand the definition of kindness. You are forced to a life of the logic of unforgiveness and hate. This will be my last statement. The president of Albania is a cardiologist, President Berisha. 3 or 4 years ago, after I was given the privilege of addressing the members of parliament, I was invited by the president to come to his home or to his office. And my traveling associate, my videographer, we went there. And President Berisha's a tall man. He went and looked out of the window. And he said to me, "Dr. Zacharias, I'm so glad you're here." He said, "Albania is the most atheistic country in the world." He said, "We've tried it our way for too long. It's time to call it a halt and try it God's way." I quoted to him what Konrad Adenauer said after the Second World War when Billy Graham went to visit him. Adenauer looked out of the window, that great statesman, and he said, "Mr. Graham, do you really believe Jesus Christ rose from the dead?" Billy Graham said, "Chancellor, if I didn't believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I would have no gospel left to preach." Adenauer looked at him and said, "Mr. Graham, as I look at the ruins of my city and my country, outside of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, there is no hope for mankind." Konrad Adenauer said that to Billy Graham. "Outside of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, there is no hope for mankind. I offer you tonight his moral law for the purpose that he's made you, his meaning, his hope, and his recovery. You need him. Don't fool yourself into believing that you don't. Ultimately, you have to live with yourself, and what's inside will destroy you unless you have God to help you triumph over that self. May God richly bless you, and thank you for giving me a hearing here."